Hina Rabbani Kaur, thank you so much for joining me on Upfront. Over 1,500 people have died as a result of catastrophic floods in Pakistan. Another 33 million people have been displaced. At least one-third of the country is underwater. Diseases are spreading rapidly. Flood damages are expected to exceed over $30 billion. You're here at the UN General Assembly. Can you talk to me a bit about the scope of the devastation in Pakistan?
Okay, so when you look at numbers which are in tens of millions, we dehumanize the number. The number becomes a number, and the humans sort of leave, and the number stays with us, right? So let me define, put it in perspective. This is a population the size of all of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. This is a population which is larger than all of Malaysia. This is an area which is the same size as the whole of the United Kingdom. That's the scale of the disaster. And then on top of that, it's a disaster, you know, as we've been saying, which is not of our making. Luckily, attributable science now exists to tell us that this is a climate change crisis disaster. So the scale is just humongous. And just to be able to grapple with the enormity of what happened and the task ahead is something that can make you hopeless. But that's the challenge for leadership, not to, and for the people who've already shown such great deal of, I don't like the word resilience, use the word resilience because it somehow means that, you know, no matter what their state, it's fine. They're living, so it's fine. I don't think it should be like that. And it isn't, it should not be like that. But in some ways it is, because I don't think we have built enough structures in the world, in the global order, in the global architecture for climate change led events to be able to grapple or deal with these crises effectively.
When you think about the global capacity to deal with these issues, as you've pointed to, some have argued the international response has been insufficient. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said, there is a lot of attention on the war in Ukraine, but people tend to forget that there is another war. The war we are waging on nature, and nature is striking back. Many have said, look, there's been a powerful response to the war in Ukraine. We saw extraordinary responses to the flooding in Europe. Has it been adequate, the global response to Pakistan?
Look, we're very thankful and grateful for whatever response we've gotten. And I think the response has been, I mean, I can tell you that countries like the UAE, for instance, have an air bridge. Countries like Turkey have assisted a lot. Many other countries, China, of course, continues to assist. The United States came in with, in large numbers in terms of, you know, on the UN flash appeal. So does the UK, many European countries. I don't really want to leave any country, but pretty much the whole world has come to help, right? But as I said, now, the scale of the crisis is 33 million people. The number of tents required is in millions, and the number of tents available is in hundreds of thousands at best. So that's the gap. How do you fill the gap? The world is not prepared to fill that gap. And that is, and therefore, you know, to me, this is literally a knock from whether you, you know, believe in Allah as we do, or Mother Nature, whatever nomenclature you use, right? This is a wake-up call, and time has already run out. But if we do not see this as a great warning of things to come, within the same season, literally, March onwards, Pakistan saw forest fires, Pakistan saw severe drought conditions, Pakistan saw 3 degrees centigrade higher temperatures, one of the hottest summers that we've ever had, in some areas far hotter than was ever even noted. There was glacial melting. In the same area that we currently have drought, there was heavy, currently have floods, there was heavy drought conditions. So if you see at the scale of all of that, you realize that this is a serious climate change event.
In August, the International Monetary Fund approved an additional $1.1 billion in bailout funds to Pakistan. Now, as is often the case with IMF loans, there are conditions. The condition is often austerity. And in this case, in fact, austerity was one of the conditions. The government under Prime Minister Shehbaz Sharif has eliminated fuel and power subsidies, and diesel pump prices have gone up by almost 60%. People are struggling with double-digit inflation. In August, your prime minister said that Pakistan is, quote, economically enslaved by the IMF. So then why take the money?
Look, this is how it works, right? You need macroeconomic stability for the country to have a chance. In order to have macroeconomic stability, you need a fund program to be able to enable other funding sources to come. This is how the financial global architecture works. You know this better than I can explain to you. Now, when we have the floods in Pakistan, and floods of a biblical proportion, okay? So this is an extraordinary event, not on a Pakistan scale. This is an extraordinary event on a global scale. This is an event which was not triggered by irresponsible behavior of Pakistan. This was an event which was triggered by irresponsible behavior of decades old of industrialization, which did not happen to have in my country or the poor 33 million people who are now on the receiving end of it. Having said that, what do you expect these 33 million people to do? To have first drowned into floods, now drowned into conditionalities. An extraordinary event like this requires extraordinary response. My fear is, having seen how the structures work, that we will come in crumbs of ordinary responses. And my fear is that the people who have drowned in these floods, the crumbs will be too less for them, right? And whereas now you could avert a problem by rebuilding resiliently in an adaptable with adaptation as its core and give hope. But our concern is that when it comes to the hard phase of rebuilding resiliently as we want to, when the numbers are to the tune of $30 billion, just the replacement cost, not the rebuilding cost perhaps, then how short will we fall? And if we fall short, what will be the cost of that? It will not only be to Pakistan, it will be to everyone, I think.
Indeed. So there's the question of what we do if we don't receive funds, right? That's a question that you've addressed. But there's also the question of what happens when you receive funds and you can end up in a very familiar cycle, which is that you receive IMF funding, you get conditional assistance, and you end up trapped in a kind of cycle of receiving this stuff, but not necessarily improving, not necessarily developing because of all the commitments you've made in order to receive the conditional funding.
Actually, I'm not so fond of the commitments that we make for other people's sake. I'm fond of commitments that we make for our own people's sake. I think this whole cycle of trying to appease other people's commitments rather than commitments to your own people is a bad cycle. And this is how the global donor architecture works, right? So there'll be all these conditionalities attached by different headquarters who want to now create a project which will appease their conscience more than the realities on the ground in some ways. And by the time it hits the ground in Pakistan, it's perhaps not really according to the requirements of the people of Pakistan, right? It's a typical cycle. We need to come up with a model in the projectized mode, which is not only sellable, but it is something which builds in adaptability, resilience, but is also fully in tune, in line with the demands and needs of the people, and not only catering to the needs of, you know, what we may consider the funding may be coming from, right?
What do you make of the argument that mega projects such as dams have actually worsened natural disasters? Do you worry that Pakistan's current investments in mega projects versus the kind of climate-resilient local infrastructure approach is putting people at danger?
Okay, that's an interesting approach, right? Because about 10 years from today, or 12 years from today, Pakistan wanted to start third coal projects with World Bank funding and financing. And we were told, oh, we do not do coal anymore, right? Now, so it was fine for all the developed world to have done coal, but when Pakistan wanted to exploit its own natural resources, you know, to be able to provide energy, we were unable to do that with funding from the World Bank. I believe that what you have to look at is cumulative responsibility, cumulative emissions. So if I'm an emitter 20 years back, and I have emitted at will, and now I'm going to not pay the price for it, but have developing countries with low, you know, capacity and low resources to pay the entire price of my emissions. So I, you know, countries like, you see, with the Ukraine crisis, a conflict happens and people have started their coal plants again. So we are not allowed and they are allowed. So there's an inbuilt element of unfairness in all of this.
Back in 2010, floods killed nearly 2,000 people.
Yeah.
I say to say Pakistan's been here before. 11 million people were displaced then as well. And yet Amira Sowas, a climate and water expert on Pakistan, said that in 2022, quote, there's just nothing in Pakistan in terms of disaster resilient infrastructure. and that people were literally left to fend for themselves. Now, your party was in power for 3 years after the 2010 floods. That critique applies to you and your party, no?
No, I would like to really be able to ask her the certain questions that would be required to be asked. That what do you call resilience and readiness? So if a country experiences, if New York City today, where we're sitting, Manhattan, the heart of the world, of the developed world, right, were to get for 8 days 800% more rain than it typically does, it will drown, right? The typical catchment areas which receive monsoon rain and flooding in Pakistan did not receive rain at all. They were still in drought conditions. So we are still looking at it from a monsoon lens, where this is a climate lens.
Is there anything that could have been done, though? From an infrastructure perspective, is there anything that...
From an infrastructure perspective, much more can be done, absolutely.
What could have been done?
So let me tell you very clearly what could have been done and what will be done as we rebuild, inshallah. So the thing to notice is that the typical areas which receive monsoon did not receive the same amount of rainfall that they typically... So this happened in an atypical area, in a non-typical area. Now, despite having said that, what we need to do is that wherever we build back, we have channels to make sure that the flow of water can be managed much better than it could. And we build back infrastructure in a way, for instance, some of the schools withstood, right? That you build back in a way that they can survive such severity of water. And the first priority must be to ensure that the water can be channeled better. But please understand the enormity of the challenge at hand. 33 million people, I will share this with you. A lot of people came on the TV screens, and then you go to them and said, we received nothing. And they're not lying. They actually did not receive anything. How can you feed 33 million people all at the same time? When we went to the whole world, and the whole world came out, opened their hearts, opened their storages, gave us whatever tents they had. You know how many tents we received? Less than a million. You know how many people were displaced? 33 million. So I think the global order is ill-prepared to be able to deal with what is coming our way. I am not kidding.
But there's
you.
Also
I
don't say this. Pakistan is facing an economic crisis, and yet it was announced in June that the country would be increasing its defense budget by 11%. At the same time, it reduced the allocation for its public sector development program by 19%. Why has the government chosen to increase military spending rather than allocating those funds for the necessary infrastructure to protect people from the climate crisis?
Mm-hmm. Sure. I could not say that that's a road that we want to go at all. I think the trend had been in Pakistan that in real terms, military spending was actually decreasing. Now here also, when it comes to real terms, I think the increase would be very, very minimal just to keep up with existing infrastructure. And that's why it's really important. And therefore, I was in a session which was on humanitarian assistance, and they kept on talking about how the humanitarian assistance needs are increasing. And I said that from one side, we are feeding the beast of creating humanitarian assistance requirements more because conflict is increasing, economic starvation is increasing, climate change triggered events are increasing. We're doing nothing to deal with the crisis, with the reason, with the basis for the crisis, whether it's climate change or economic starvation, food crisis has been triggered by all conflict. In our region, conflict is right now being triggered in some ways.
But climate change would be still the biggest threat to national security at this point, right?
I mean, it certainly is, yeah.
Right. In 2015, the UN conducted a drill simulating an earthquake in the Indian Ocean, and it was found that the tsunami waves from an earthquake could reach Karachi in 1.5 hours and wipe out the entire city. Again, what good is to have large military if Karachi, the economic backbone and main city, is underwater?
You know, to be honest, things have changed in our region, right? I mean, since 1971, we really did not have an active conflict. If you don't take a few, you know, minor conflicts, take them away. But on 2 years back, we had from a neighbor, military jets enter Pakistani airspace, proclaimed Pakistani airspace into our territory and into our territory. I went back, and later on, it was proven that the claims that they made of you know, going after terrorist outfits, etc., none existed, only trees existed over there, right? Now, when something like this happens, I cannot make the case that we don't need military spending anymore. We need to have jets which are in a position to be able to fight back. So when you have confrontations like that, you are ensuring that our wish, our desire to be able to swerve away completely from that type of spending and go into serious, you know, adaptability. Forget adaptability. I mean, adaptability is a major part of what we need to do, but there's also, we're still struggling with proper education infrastructure, proper health infrastructure, proper farm-to-market roads, proper economic infrastructure, right? So when a country like this, which has many, many places to spend its resources in, is forced to relook at, you know, military spending again. And if you'd notice, I mean, all over the world, military spending is currently being celebrated, isn't it?
And critiqued.
And honestly, critiqued
all over, right?
No, Mark, I think there was a time when it was being critiqued. But right now, if you look at, you know, I think Trump also started talking about what percentage of GDP are you spending on military. And now everybody's celebrating, yes, we are increasing military spending. And those countries which were not carrying large armies are now carrying, are showing intention to. So we are actually feeding the beast right now. Mm. And this is a time when really, I think there will be no earth left for us to conduct wars. And then I think the Secretary General said something to this extent in this. And I have to say that I understand that the UN may not be the most celebrated body right now, but I have deep respect, deep abiding requests for Antonio Guterres for at least saying the right stuff, right? For calling out where we are falling miserably, miserably behind than what leadership requires right now in terms of fighting for the SDGs, fighting for real, real climate change, not only adaptability financing, but looking at the whole architecture and saying that why should we not be ahead of the curve, why behind the curve.
Hina Rabbani Kar, thank you so much for joining us on Upfront.
Yeah.